Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today we are exploring the fundamentals of threatened and endangered species restoration using the ongoing story of the Pinto abalone as the Salish Sea's only abalone species. But before we do that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, even if you quickly recognize these sounds, and you may, there is a special twist. See if you can identify what might be different about these sounds. And we'll come back later in the recording and talk about them a little bit more. My guest this week is Josh Bauma. Josh is the Abalone Program Director with the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. Josh is a shellfish biologist, scientific diver, and abalone recovery program director for the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. And I think Josh's is true, has basically been focused on efforts to restore healthy populations of the Pinto abalone to the Salish Sea. That's what Josh does. He also manages the Port Madison Community Shellfish Farm, and Josh is actually talking to us via Zoom today from the labs that NOAA has, their abalone hatching and rearing labs, at their Manchester Research Station. It's sort of down near Port Orchard. And then on Sunday, January the 22nd, Josh will present the next talk in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Oceans lecture series. The talk is in person. It's at the Fort Warden Chapel at 3 p.m. And for more information about that, go to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center website. Well, we've talked actually about Pinto abalone several times over the years on Nature Now. The most recent one was in October and December of 2020. And you can listen to those podcasts on KPTZ's website. Today, we'll get an update on the restoration efforts. And we're kind of going to delve into the sort of scientific process and the questions that need to be considered when doing a restoration effort. How does that work? How do you plan to restore species that are threatened and endangered? A quick background on the Pinto abalone. It's a little guy, 4 to 6 inches long. I think they're actually wonderfully cute. They're usually nicely colored, sort of pink. They have that sort of basic structure that those big abalones we can envision from the California coast. One big lustrous shell with some holes that are for waste removal and water and release of gametes or reproductive cells. They graze on algae and they munch on kelp. And they were a food source for the indigenous peoples of our area. Unfortunately, although they were once widely distributed in the Northeast Pacific, the Pinto abalone population dwindled dramatically. The data I have is that in Washington alone, scientists documented a decrease of 97% of the population from 1992 to 2017. And then in 2019, Washington State listed it as an endangered species. So, Josh, first of all, what happened that took this species to the point of essentially being a non-viable population where it was, we could still find them, but I think, functionally extinct? What happened?
Yeah, that can be a really complicated question, Nan, and there's a lot of different directions we can go in answering that, but it's good to just start by talking about the range of this particular species. Pinto abalone are unique in that they range, all the way from Sitka, Alaska in the north down to Baja, California in the south. So of all the West Coast species, there's 7 species on the West Coast here. Pinto abalone is the one that has by far the widest range. And they're really patchily distributed along that range. So these guys really prefer that dynamic, rocky reef, current-swept habitat where you'd see a significant kelp canopy overhead. But they're really, as I mentioned, patchily distributed along that whole range. And depending on where you are in that range, you know, we have different amounts of knowledge about what the population is like. That's one of the unique things about working on pinto abalone here in Washington. It's the only abalone species that we have in Washington. And we know quite a bit about them because it's the only abalone species we have here. And WDFW has been following populations for quite some time. You know, along that range, we also had really different harvest pressures. You know, when you talk about losing a species, over harvest is often a contributor, and that's certainly the case with abalone. You had intense commercial harvest pressures on abalone in California. Mm-hmm. You also had the same thing in Canada. But here in Washington, because we only have this one species, there weren't significant enough numbers here to actually have a commercial harvest for the species. There was a fairly intense recreational harvest. Scuba divers found this to be a really popular sport diving activity. Mm-hmm. And along with that, you know, came quite a bit of poaching activity as well. As you mentioned, WDFW has done a really, really good job of tracking populations all the way back, you know, into the early 90s. Because of that, you know, there was concern that these harvest pressures were too much. The recreational harvest was closed. And the assumption was, this is our strategy. Let's close the harvest and see if the species can rebound.
So that's often a strategy people use when you're looking at conservation, is you just stop the harvest.
Yep, that's the first, easiest, most basic step. Let's take away that pressure and see if this species can recover on its own. That number that you mentioned, 97% of loss of the population, that's a really
that's a huge number.
Yeah. Number. And that was over a 25-year period. So clearly the removal of that recreational harvest pressure and the associated poaching that was happening along with it, clearly that wasn't enough. And that's when we start to look at, you know, the biology of this animal and other reasons why, you know, we're not seeing a rebound of the population. You know, abalone are broadcast spawning invertebrates. So they have this unique reproductive strategy where they're putting their gametes into the water column and hoping for the best. Mm-hmm. But, you know, along with that strategy, they need to be in dense aggregations for that strategy to work.
Increase the probabilities.
That's right. Those males and females all need to be in the same place at the same time. Those gametes need to meet in the water column. And we just don't have a dense enough or significant population for that to happen anymore. And that's, we call that the Ali effect. We're not seeing a recruitment of, you know, new generations because the reproductive population that is there is aging and is too spread out. So I think that's where we're at now. This population in Washington waters is, you know, functionally extirpated. You know, of the 10 historic population sites that we monitor, 5 of those sites don't have abalone on them anymore. So the Ali effect is a big reason for that. And of course, you know, we have to think about climate change and ocean acidification and other things that may be happening to prevent or slow down, you know, a bounce back in this population. But it really goes back to that intense harvest period in the late 80s, early 1990s, when you had this really popular recreational fishery and a significant amount of poaching happening as well.
When you, and I'll use you all, Washington Department of Fisheries, Puget Sound Restoration Fund, et cetera, what were the factors that you thought about when you were deciding to focus some restoration efforts on the pintos? I mean, it's obvious that the population is in great stress, but what were the sort of biological features that you thought about? So like why the pintos?
Yeah, that's an important question. It can seem like a small, insignificant critter. So it is important to ask, why is it important to restore this particular species? And, you know, there's a lot of answers to that question, and they're all important. But, you know, I think the first way to answer that is pinto abalone. It's the only abalone species that we have in Pacific Northwest waters, and they're unique because of that. This is a large charismatic marine snail. And as a marine snail, it has, you know, significant grazing behaviors, and it serves an ecological purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, abalone can act as ecosystem engineers, and that's kind of where their ecological importance lies. When you have a healthy rocky reef system with abalone as part of that system, their grazing behavior is going to keep that rocky reef substrate clean. And that encourages settlement and presence of all these other diverse species that utilize that same rocky reef habitat. So ecologically, they play that role. And we see a loss in the complexity of that habitat when you remove that big herbivorous, charismatic grazing snail.
So at that point, did you have enough scientific knowledge about the biology and the ecological role of the pinto abalone, or were there a number of kind of unanswered questions that you needed to explore before you could sort of take conservation steps to restore the population?
Well, you know, there's quite a few abalone species around the world, and unfortunately, they're all in decline for a lot of the same reasons. They're a species that is not well suited to heavy harvest. And so we have a lot of shared information to go on around the world on what happens, you know, when you lose abalone from your system. I think where the research came in for us is, first of all, understanding why was there a loss of this, you know, this important species here. And what are the most beneficial strategies if the species come back? And that's really where, you know, we saw an opportunity to build, you know, a collaborative group of partners who were all interested in playing a role in seeing this species come back. You know, this isn't just the Puget Sound Restoration Fund and WDFW. This is a broad collaboration of federal and state agencies, universities, nonprofits, tribes, and, you know, each organization plays its role, and research is a big part of that. And that's why, you know, we have partnerships with researchers at UW and Western, and, you know, each step that we take in this process is driven by, you know, the research that's being done, you know, by this broad collaborative group. And that's kind of really where our biggest strength lies.
So Josh, as you were talking about, there are a lot of partners and a lot of folks doing research. And I'm thinking, and sort of the design of a conservation strategy, I can see the real benefit in lots of partners doing various things. And I know, for instance, that the Marine Science Center was partnering, you know, a number of years ago on what do baby abalone eat, and what is their preferred food, how do they gain weight, what are the other kinds of things that researchers were wanting to know in order to make this an effective restoration effort?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it kind of starts with deciding, is conservation aquaculture of the species, will that be our primary strategy? And if so, what questions do we need to begin with in order to run an efficient and, you know, healthy, genetically diverse aquaculture program? And so, yeah, those research questions become really important. Can we find the broodstock that we need to run this program? Can we condition those broodstock in a way that we can get, you know, we can induce them to spawn when we need them to? Do we know how to rear the larvae in a productive way? Once we settle them out into culture tanks at our various, you know, nursery facilities, do we know what their optimal diet is? What should we be feeding them? You know, and a lot of these questions are tied to what's happening in the field as well. So what are the ideal, you know, water chemistry parameters that we need to be looking at to both culture this animal efficiently and then be able to put juvenile animals into the wild with a good chance of succeeding and surviving out there? So understanding how water chemistry can impact the culture and production and survival of these animals. So there are limitless research questions that we have thought about, some of which we've tackled head on, others which, you know, we're still looking at. But being able to run a kind of a research-driven conservation aquaculture program is really where, you know, where our program began.
Mm-hmm. I guess at this point, let's come up to date. It's 2023. That's hard to imagine. When did this project start?
Well, I think the earliest efforts began back in the 2003, 2004.
Okay, so it's been about a couple decades
into this program now. And we've come a long ways. You know, we wanted to take a very slow, iterative approach to recovering the species. You know, one of the basic tenets in restoring any species is how do you go about doing it in a way that causes no harm to what's left of wild populations or wild stocks?
Oh, that's so an interesting question. I'm thinking immediately about genetics.
Yeah.
And salmon. I mean, that's one of the questions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's the biggest question that a lot of folks ask when you talk about restoring a species. What may you be doing that could have a negative effect on that existing remaining population? So we've really tried to think about that right from the start and take this approach of, you know, doing no harm to what's left of wild populations of pinto abalone in Washington waters. And that's particularly important, too, when you talk about, you know, developing a conservation aquaculture program. And that, you know, that's become our primary strategy for recovering the species. We've spent a long time developing the recovery plan here in Washington, and we've explored and researched a number of different strategies. But really where we've landed is our main goal here is to use conservation aquaculture and hatchery-produced juvenile abalone to supplement wild stocks. So that's when this this idea of doing no harm to existing mm-hmm. populations really comes to the forefront. And you're right, genetics is a big part of that.
So you're 20 years on, more or less. What's new? How are you doing?
You know, we over the last several years feel like we've really laid some groundwork to springboard this program from, you know, pilot scale to full scale restoration across the range in Washington. We're to the point now where we have 27 established recovery sites in the San Juan Islands. We have outplanted somewhere around 45,000 juveniles to those sites. And we have approximately 200 genetically distinct families that we've produced here at the hatchery. So we've really stayed true to that goal of producing mm-hmm. you know, genetically diverse F1 population here in the hatchery that then gets released in the wild.
Do you have any idea? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, we've long wondered if, you know, what the genetic implications or what kind of effects we may be having, you know, to date. And so we tackled that over the last few years and have actually explored the genetics of the families that we've produced here in the hatchery, the families that are surviving on outplant sites, and comparing those to our kind of historic broodstock population that we've used and what's left of wild stocks in the San Juans. And I think we're really in the right place in terms of the genetic diversity of what's getting put out there and how that relates to what's left in the wild. So it was a really good feeling to kind of answer that question and feel like we're on the right track genetically. But it's just, you know, it's another reason to continue on that path. And we do our best to collect new broodstock every year so that we have fresh genetics coming into the hatchery. And we really stay true to that goal of, you know, doing no harm to what's in the wild and keeping our genetic diversity here in the hatchery.
How are you measuring success?
Well, you can answer that question kind of on a short-term, temporary scale, but I think it's best to look at it first from the broader sense. And I think, you know, we measure success by looking at whether or not we have a sustainable kind of a self-sustaining population in the San Juan Islands and Washington waters. And that's kind of our ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. That's how we would measure success. The goal is to take a step back at some point, right? We don't want to be in this business of restoring abalone for the long term. And I don't know if that means 10 years or 25 years or longer, but the goal is to get to a point where we can take a step back and let nature
let the natural system work. That would be success. Yeah.
Yep.
That means lots of monitoring and lots of science. What's your sense of where you are in getting to that goal? So you mentioned a huge number of animals that you've outplanted. I'm wondering how they're doing.
I think we've made significant progress, and I think the collaboration should feel really proud of the work we've put in over the last two decades. But I also think we have a long way to go. As I mentioned earlier, we've taken a very slow, meticulous approach to this. And I think what we've learned in the past should really drive our process moving forward. And I think, we're in a good place to really scale up what we've done. 27 sites and 45,000 juveniles outplanted seems like a big number, but true recovery, I think, is going to come, at a much larger scale than that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot to learn yet. Of the sites that we've selected, I'd say two-thirds of those are productive and doing well, but a third have not done well. So in order to become more efficient and use our sparing resources well, we have to understand what makes a site perform well and what are some of the detractors to that. So that's just one example of the many things we have yet to learn in this program.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to want to keep in touch with you. And I want to remind people that Josh will be giving the Marine Science Center Future of the Oceans lecture on January 22nd. That's a Sunday, 3:00 in the chapel at Fort Worden. And Josh, let me ask you one more question. Will you have any pinto abalones there people can see?
I hadn't thought about that, but I might have to ponder whether or not I can bring some live abalone. I'll tell you what, I'll definitely have some beautiful big pinto abalone shells at the very least.
Oh, that would be great. Yes.
We'll go from there.
Okay, because I find the shells really beautiful. The colors are, I think, very stunning. And I know you've got some great photographs. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for spending time with me today. And I'm going to encourage people to attend your lecture and learn even more. And thank you for sort of helping us think through the dilemma of restoration and thinking about the strategy in this particular species of aquaculture, but how to do that in a way that recognizes that it is another manipulation of the system. And I think your sort of guiding principle there of do no harm to the wild population is a spectacular thing to remember. So thank you a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. And it's a privilege to be a part of this program. I'm working with a lot of really motivated and passionate scientists and conservationists, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Great. Well, let's hear that mystery sound again. Well, my guest this week, Josh Balma, suggested this sound. Those were the barks, whines, buzzes, and click trains of California sea lions as heard underwater by scuba divers. When I watched a video of sea lions vocalizing underwater, I was astounded. You can see these great bursts of air that just explode from their mouths. I had no idea they could do that underwater. Know, of course, that the California sea lions are among the most vocal of all mammals, and particularly during the breeding season, the males bark incessantly. They're establishing territories, and then once the territories are established, the males bark only when they're maintaining and defending those territories. And then, interestingly, during periods of non-breeding, the submissive males, the non-alpha males, actually become more vocal than the dominant males. So that was the sounds of sea lions as heard underwater. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich, and I encourage you to listen to podcasts of the program. You can find them on the KPTZ website. And if you're curious about the natural world around us, maybe enjoy talking with people, and if you can get excited about helping others appreciate the wonders of nature, then I encourage you to think about joining the Nature Now team. If interested, contact us at naturenow@kptz.org. Thanks again for listening. And the ending music is a little ditty called The Abalone Song, and it's an original song from the Aquarium of the Pacific that tells the story of abalones and abalone restoration.
Where they can grow up in peace, and just to make sure that they don't get